Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie, as always, here with John. How's it going?
Man, it's going good. How about you?
Things are going well over here. Super excited about today's case. This is something that I've been looking forward to for a really long time. So excited to dig into that. But of course, we always have a little bit of housekeeping to do.
Yeah, first and foremost, I want to thank Candace for coming in at the $3 a month level over on Patreon. Candace took advantage of a 15% discount when she joined an annual membership. So thank you, Candace. Candace and any other folks who want to join Patreon get bonus episodes each and every month, only available to Patreon members, and early ad-free content from our regular show. So you get Tuesday's show on Monday and Friday's show on Thursday.
Love that logic. No commercials whatsoever. So if that's of interest to you, that is, for most, seems to be worth the price of admission in and of its own. Also want to give a thanks to Julia Reed 07 over on Apple Podcasts. Wrote a 5-star review. It says, literally, not figuratively, the best true crime podcast. Jamie and John are wonderful. Scott, who is referenced in their latest episode, probably is fresh out of jail.
Hey, I know her. And yeah, thanks for listening to this show, and thank you for doing great work in our home county. We appreciate it.
Scott is a Mothman expert. We featured him over on Bless Their Hearts a few months ago. If that's a mystery you're interested in, you want to go check that out.
It was really good, really good episode. So thank you, Scott and Julie. We appreciate it. Jamie, any other housekeeping, or is that going to knock it out?
Yeah, I think we kind of zoomed through it, mostly for me out of excitement, John. This is a case that I've known about for years. I've done some deep dives into on various fronts that we'll get into when we get into the case. But man, so many things going on. I think this case in and of itself brings in so many different factors that we cover regularly, and they're all kind of wrapped into one case that has spanned decades and keeps going. So without further ado, why don't you get us rolling?
I know you pretty well, Jamie, and I know this case is going to push a lot of your buttons. So I'm sure we're going to spend a lot of time discussing this one. But to take you back to when this case all started, it was June 15th, 1998. Jamie, I was in high school or going into high school. You were probably going into sophomore year, yeah, if I'm not mistaken.
I thought you were going to call me old. We can move past that. No,
you're only a year older than me. Yeah. But this is in Toledo, Ohio, and that's where one night two men came upon a sight that will never leave their memory. Laying in the middle of the road one night was a little boy, 13-year-old Maurice Purify. This young boy had been shot once in the chest and 4 times in the head. He was wearing shoes, but they had been removed and they were laying next to him, and his pockets had been turned inside out. So kind of tells me that somebody wanted to rob this teenager, went through his pockets, got his stuff out if there was anything in it. When rescue crews arrived, the first thing they thought was that this was a victim of a hit and run, that somebody had ran over this young man and then fled the scene. But when they rolled the body over, that's when they saw the bullet holes, and especially the ones that were in the back of his head. They returned the body back to the way it was, and they called for detectives and declared the area to be a murder scene.
We talk about murders like this usually in bigger cities. Toledo is a big city, but I think it's one that we don't think of as a big city. But this kind of thing does happen there. Regardless, this was a huge story in the news. The investigation began with pretty much no information. You find this very young man, younger than one of my kids, on the street, dead from gunshot wounds, and everybody's going to want to know what happened. Maurice had allegedly been over at his girlfriend's house, and it started to look like it was going to rain. And the last that anybody ever heard from him was Maurice telling his girlfriend that he was going to go ahead, leave, and walk back to his house to try to get ahead of the weather so he wouldn't get rained on. Investigators started canvassing the neighborhood, and they couldn't find anybody who said that they saw anything. There were some people that say that they heard some loud noises that could have been gunshots before sunrise. They found seven 25 caliber rounds, the shells, around the body. You mentioned the five gunshot wounds. There were also two wounds on the torso that could have been grazing gunshot wounds. But other than that, there was not a lot of physical evidence there. The only evidence was Maurice's body. And along with the bullet holes, Maurice had also been physically assaulted very badly and was in very bad shape.
So, Jamie, you're familiar with crime, right? Like, I don't know about Harlan, but in East Tennessee, if there was a bad crime that was committed, they would post it on the news and call you to call or tell you to call something like Crime Stoppers to report any
tips. A tip line. Yeah. If anybody knows anything about this crime, if you've seen this missing person or know this suspect we're looking for, here is a number that you can call. You can be anonymous if you want to, but basically we'll do anything we need to get information.
So they open that up, and as early as the next morning, they receive their first tip. And on that call, a caller said that they overheard Aaron Pettis say that he was the one who killed Maurice because the kid owed him money. Now, the cops are already familiar with Pettis because of some drug convictions, but let's back up. The night before Maurice was killed, there was a burglary which occurred at the home of Terry Lake. Terry Lake was a friend of Pettis, and the two were at a local festival during the burglary. A witness identified Maurice as the burglar. Police got a search warrant for Pettis' home to investigate whether Pettis and Lake were Maurice's killers out of retaliation for the burglary. Now, it is important to note that there is no public record that Maurice was questioned about the burglary. The Crime Stoppers tip also accused Maurice of being a drug dealer, but there is no evidence of that. Police brought in Pettis for questioning, and he demanded a polygraph test, which he took, and he passed, so police released him.
We go back and forth about this often, John. I think there are things you can tell from whether somebody's attitude about a polygraph test, but I don't really trust the results that much, especially just to let somebody go. It doesn't seem like in all of the files from this case, I don't think they ever followed up with Aaron Pettis again. And I think we're going to see that he was actually, even with the polygraph test, a better suspect than those we're going to run into in a few minutes.
Can I just say, like, if I'm brought in for a crime, even if I didn't commit it, I'm going to be so nervous to take this test because I would know that my freedom hinges in the balance, right? So I don't know. I'd probably fail it just because of how freaking nervous I would be.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I think I would always fail it. I think there are some people that are just going to always pass it. Their lives are much more stressful than a polygraph test, so it's not going to ruffle their feathers enough to tip the scales there. But they let Aaron go, and the tips dried up for about 2 months, and then they had a call come in from somebody named Sharonda Rayford. She said that her boyfriend, whose name was Travis Slaughter, had told her that he was involved in the death of Maurice Purify. She said Travis said he did it because Maurice had owed him money. Travis wasn't somebody that was well known to the police. He was a suspect in a sexual assault case, a statutory case against a 12-year-old girl. But otherwise, he didn't have a big rap sheet. He wasn't known to be violent. The police brought 19-year-old Travis in for questioning, and his story changed several times. They questioned him for around 6 hours, John. Now, there's a big story to go with. Kind of, I've been digging really into wrongful convictions and coerced confessions lately. So, some things that I've learned to look for in a potential coerced confession are trait and state factors. Trait factors being long-term things. Your
IQ.
You're low IQ, you're young, whatever state of life you're in. So some of those trait factors, Travis is a low IQ individual. He was 19, so not necessarily a young teenager, but
I don't know. Yeah. You're really immature at 19 years old. Let's be honest.
Yeah, your brain's not fully developed till you're in your mid to late 20s is what research is showing now. But let's say those are two trait factors. State factors are current temporary things. So, like
the fact that Travis was probably hungover when he took a polygraph test.
He was very hungover. He had been smoking marijuana, so he was high. He had not had anything to eat that day, and he was exhausted. He was in there for 6 hours, and police get the ability to in and out, to trade, to tag people in, to come in and take a break.
I'm sorry, we're probably talking way too much about it in the beginning, but they are also able to just straight up lie to a low IQ 19-year-old kid who's hungover.
Yeah, and he had several trait and state factors that could lead back to a coerced confession. The way that they arrested him, they essentially had a big squad of people in gear that just burst into his apartment while he was sitting on the couch. So it was a really traumatic day for him, obviously. But eventually, he would start to name some names. Early on in his interrogation, he mentioned, they asked him, well, who are your friends? Who do you hang out with? He said, I don't have any friends. I used to have these friends, but they've turned their back on me. And eventually, we work our way back around to these friends. Their names are Carl Willis and Wayne Braddy. And he said that they were the ones that killed Maurice Purify and that Travis was a lookout. Now, given this was on the back end of this interrogation section, he had been questioned for 6 hours. So he went from, I don't know anything, to I was there and saw a killer, to I was the lookout for somebody I didn't know, to I was the lookout for these two guys. Like, there were several iterations to this story.
But there were 25 denials before this.
Yes, yes. Wayne and Carl were both 19 years old, like Travis, and they had just gotten into a big argument with Travis over clothing. They said that, or Travis would say in later years, that he was really jealous of Wayne and Carl's clothes, so he started to take their clothes from them. And at some point, they were like, look, dude, you got to get my clothes back or pay for them. And he ended up not doing either. So they had just had a falling out recently before this. And he would say that Wayne and Carl killed Maurice over drugs. He was the lookout, and he admitted, I was complicit in this. I knew what was happening. So then police, I don't know, I think of the Pavlov's dog, where you get a reward for responding to the bell, or a mouse at the end of a maze. He finally said what they wanted him to say. So they gave him a burger. They gave him a fries. They gave him a break to smoke some cigarettes. So they rewarded Travis for saying the things they wanted to hear.
Well, so the police would visit Wayne, and when they did, he had just returned from a family vacation when the Toledo Police Department arrested him for the murder of Maurice Purify. Now, Travis entered a plea deal the next year, admitting involvement in the murder, and in return, he received a sentence of 18 years, and that included time for the rape of a child. So basically, two sentences rolled up into one, right? Carl was picked up by police and immediately offered an alibi later that was supported by several people. Carl said that he was with a girlfriend, Donna Flowers, and they were babysitting his sister's children. The couple were supposed to go out with his sister, but Carl's allergies were bothering him, so he stayed in, leaving for 1 hour to pick up pizza early in the evening. When police talked to Donna, she had two kids. Donna called Carl while he was in jail, saying the police were intimidating her, trying to get her to take back her support of Carl's alibi. Now, they were threatening to take her children, and Donna would not testify at the trial later.
Yeah, so inferring here that police were heavily involved in deterring witnesses from providing those alibis or testing on behalf of the defense. This one's a big one for me, John. This tells me a lot of what I feel like I need to know. Initially, the grand jury did not find probable cause to indict Carl and Wayne. There's this old adage that you can indict a ham sandwich. An indictment hearing at a grand jury allows the prosecution to go on and on about everything they have unchecked. There's no defense presented. It's basically them just saying, look at all this evidence I have. Is this enough for a trial? And so basically here, what they're going on is just Travis Slaughter's confession. And the grand jury said, this is not enough. So they can't bring this back to the grand jury until they get new information. And that was when Chandrea's testimony came into effect, and they presented that to a grand jury a second time, and they were indicted. So the fact that there was so little evidence not to get indicted the first time throws up a big red flag for me. But they did get an additional witness, so that is something. So they went to trial in the year 2000, and Chandrea was called to testify. She refused after she was questioned for just a little bit. You can find her testimony script online. Basically, she says, I'm this old. I've been Travis's girlfriend for this long. I know he hangs out with these guys. And then she just stops answering questions in the middle of the prosecution's questioning of her. She refuses to answer questions. She refuses to take the stand for the defense to cross-examine her. She's sentenced to 30 days in jail for contempt of court for not doing so. But one of the tenets of our legal system, John, is that you get to face your accuser. Like, if somebody's going to try testify against you, your team gets to question them, but that didn't happen here. And that is obviously a big problem. So the defense should have and could have filed a motion for a mistrial based on this, but they didn't. They filed a motion that the judge would do a curative instruction, basically saying to the jury, hey, just forget everything she said and pretend like she wasn't here. Is that a reasonable request for a juror?
Yeah, man. I mean, look, I'm going to be on a jury here in like a few weeks, right? And if I hear something in court, I can't forget that. I don't have like a Men in Black flashy thing to like erase that from my memory. So I think the reasonable thing to do, especially in a daggone murder trial, you start a new trial. It sucks. It costs a lot of money. It's inconvenient, but justice and lives hang in the balance. So no, I don't think it's fair that the jurors were just told to forget about it.
Absolutely.
Because you can't forget about it.
You can't. And we'll come back to that later when some jurors spoke out about that. Travis would take the stand, and he told a story about the night of Maurice Purifoy's death, where he told a story that was completely different. If you decide to go listen to his whole 6-hour confession or look at the statement he wrote, his story's changed by the time we get to trial. He originally mentioned the weapon was a 380, but by the time we get to trial, it's conveniently a 25, which is what was used in the murder. So a lot of changes from that original testimony or confession he gave. Carl and Wayne would be convicted of murder after 26 hours of jury deliberation. After 18 hours, the jury came back and said, hey, we're deadlocked. We can't reach a verdict. And the judge said, try again. 8 hours later, magically, they all agreed that they were guilty. But the only witness that provided anything against them was Travis Slaughter. There were forensic witnesses, but they didn't tie anything to Carl or Wayne. When the verdict was read aloud, Carl screamed out in the courtroom, for something I didn't do? For something I didn't do? He said it 3 times. Wayne was shocked, just shaking his head. After Carl was taken away, his attorney, whose name was Peter Boyer, set his briefcase on a chair, hung a coat over it, and just walked out of the courtroom and went and drove around for a couple hours. This is the last murder trial he ever did, and he kind of hung it up. And if you talk to Carl and Wayne, they'll tell you that we had other witnesses. We had questions we wanted to ask, but Boyer kept telling us, they have to prove you're guilty and they've got nothing. We don't need to do this. I would think if lives hang in the balance, like you said earlier, put everything you have out there, leave no doubt, leave no doubt at all. And by that, I mean, show all the doubt, all the reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
Carl and Wayne have always maintained their innocence. And to be honest, John, there's still a lot of murky waters in this case. So we'll dig more into the ongoing story of Maurice Purifoy's murder and whether or not we get to the bottom of who killed him.
In 2000, Travis sent a letter to Wayne apologizing about lying about Wayne and Carl's involvement. I mean, he's recanted his story at this point. He promised to get on cameras, get in the newspapers, get into the TV channels to confess to everybody that these men were innocent and that he basically made everything up. He wrote more letters to both of the men. In those, he begged for the men's forgiveness about lying to them. He also claimed that he was jealous of Wayne and Carl's friendship and angry that he wasn't like a part of their close circle of friends. There was actually another letter, Jamie, in that he told Wayne that he was HIV positive. And one of Travis's former inmates at the prison actually was there when Travis got this news. And the inmate would later say that he had come down to see a nurse talking to Travis about this diagnosis. And Travis would say, "This is God's punishment for me lying about what happened."
And 2002, Travis talked again about the murder and this time signed an affidavit. In that document that was in sworn testimony, he recants all of the testimony that he said on the stand against Carl and Wayne. He says that he alone was who killed Maurice Purify, and later on he's going to say that he had nothing to do with it either, that he wouldn't know if Carl and Wayne were there because he wasn't either, but at this point, he's trying to make amends for what he did, essentially, to his former friends. In 2016, Travis was released from prison and sent to a halfway house where he would be tracked as a registered sex offender. Again, this is going back to the sexual assault of a 12-year-old girl. He gave an interview in 2019 where he said, "Without a doubt, Carl and Wayne were not present and had no involvement in this crime." Travis also admits that he made up the story just so he would get a reduced sentence for the sexual assault charge.
Understandably, Wayne was angry with Travis for a long time. Wayne had taken Travis in off the street. He had fed him, got him a job, gave him a warm place to sleep. He was really acting like a mentor to this guy who had nothing. Wayne still says that he loves Travis like a brother, but they had a falling out when Travis started stealing their things. Wayne and Carl tell the same story about the last time all three of them were together. And in that story, they say that Travis came to Carl's mom's house and asked Carl to come out into the alley. Carl said, "If you want to talk to me, you can come in here and do it." And that's when Carl and Wayne confronted Travis and said that they simply could not be friends anymore because of the stealing. Travis actually referenced that incident in one of the letters saying, "I swear I wanted to kill you and Willis that day. I felt so embarrassed and humiliated."
There is a story that he would invite them over to his sister's house and that he actually tried to lure them into the attic where he did plan to cause them physical harm. And he's admitted that since. So his anger toward them and everything they had done for him or to him, like, none of that's embellished. They really, at the point of his arrest, they were his enemies. So to Travis, this was his chance to get a deal and to put these guys away. So why doesn't Travis just show up to an appellate hearing and recant his testimony in person? He had the opportunity to, John, but the lead prosecutor says that Travis's plea deal that he had signed way back when would be in jeopardy if he were to come out and recant. So if he recanted his testimony and it led to something changing about Carl and Wayne's sentences, then his case would be brought back up and reassessed, and he could go back to prison himself. There was a local news station that found that the original plea deal said in part of it, "If Slaughter does not provide truthful testimony, then the agreement is null and void, and he waives his defense against double jeopardy," meaning he could be tried again for what he's done, even if he's already sentenced, and then original charges would be reinstated. So if he admits that he lied on the stand, his plea deal is null and void. One of his letters to Carl indicated that he became aware of this, and he apologized, saying, "When y'all are eventually set free, they'll try to reindict me, won't they?" They can too, huh? So obviously he's found himself in the situation, "I want to apologize, I want to make amends, but I'm not willing to go back to jail for it."
Let's talk about Chandrea Rayford. This is Travis's girlfriend. So the original plan was for her that she would come to the stand and talk about a call that she overheard between the men when they had talked about the murder. So when she was called to the stand, the only thing that she would say is that the men were all friends. When she stopped answering questions, She was held in contempt of court for 30 days. In 2012, she provided an affidavit saying Carl and Wayne were innocent. She also explained Travis killed Maurice because Travis had made a sexual advance towards Maurice and Maurice turned him down, threatening to tell people that Travis was gay. Now, this was the first time investigators from the Ohio Innocence Project started to see a narrative about what happened. And it came to light even though prosecutors continued to call Chandrea the girlfriend, even though she was never Travis's girlfriend because Travis is gay. Travis also revealed his sexual identity to Wayne in those prison letters. If this story is true, then Chandrea's lie was part of the evidence used to indict Carl and Wayne in the second grand jury hearing.
This is one of many, many rumors that are out there. I don't even buy that Travis was absolutely gay. I really think he had, he may have been bisexual, he may have been experimenting, whatever, but I, based on the myriad of stories I've heard, there are only a few of those that would suggest this, but this is what Chandrea comes out and says. And the other weird part involves the jury foreman. His name is John Cry. He was in his early 20s and in the military at the time of this trial. He recalls the trial was only 10 hours long, and again, we mentioned the deliberation was 26 hours. One big sticking point for the jury, according to Cry, was Chandrea's refusal to testify. After she was taken into contempt of court, the judge ordered them again to disregard her testimony, and he said what you and I talked about earlier. This is a direct quote. I'm sorry. You don't forget what you heard. She's the only one who said these guys were friends, that they hung out. Then she left, and I believe our assumption was that she's scared of these guys, and that's why she's not testifying. After reading all this stuff 20 years later, that was a false impression that definitely didn't help these guys. The prosecution only pushed the idea that Chandrea was afraid of Carl and Wayne, and that's why she didn't want to testify. Local news outlets in Toledo, however, talked to Chandrea in 2019, and she said the reason she didn't testify was because she knew if she continued along her story that she was going to be telling a lie on the stand. So she decided that instead of recanting, instead of going back on what she had said in that initial phone call, she was just going to shut up. She said she was never afraid of Carl or Wayne. And going back to the jury foreman, Cry said again, I don't regret my decision. I think I and the others made the best decision based on what we were given at the time. However, having read back through everything and seeing the testimony, seeing some of the things that weren't presented back then, seeing some of the evidence that's missing, finding out about a lot of things, I personally would love to see them get another opportunity to plead their case. And an interesting side note, Maurice's brother, Maurice Purify's brother, has also come to believe that Wayne and Carl are completely innocent of this. Like we mentioned earlier, they had alibis, but they weren't brought up at trial.
Other developments since the trial include Donna Flowers, this was Carl's girlfriend at the time, filling out an affidavit for the Ohio Innocence Project, reconfirming his story. She said she knew exactly where he was at the time because it was her birthday week and Carl was with her all week. Our investigation concluded Donna's birthday is in June. When the Ohio Innocence Project got involved, they poked holes in the prosecution's weak evidence. First, there was no DNA evidence proving that Carl and Wayne were at the scene. That's pretty important, right? Now, this is weird because Travis testified that Carl was right on top of Maurice when he pulled the trigger, but Wayne and Carl's clothes and shoes were never tested for blood spatter. I mean, that seems like, you know, if they could locate those clothes and find blood, then sure, that's one thing, but they don't have that. The murder weapon also was never discovered. There was no witness other than Travis, and no blood linking the men to the murder was found.
So we have two people that accused them. Both have recanted. Why are they still in jail? That's where this gets complicated. Appeals have been filed asking for a new trial, but the most recent decision by Judge Cook in the Lucas County Common Pleas Court says that Wayne and Carl have not done enough to prove they deserve a new trial. When you're on trial for murder, like your back's against the wall, but once you're convicted, it's so difficult to even get in a setting where you can plead your case. Earlier this week, we aired an interview with Elizabeth Franklin Best, who's a an attorney for people who believe they're wrongfully convicted. And we talked at length about how difficult it is to overcome this. Judge Cook acknowledges that Travis lied multiple times during the investigation. And even the prosecution at this point says, yeah, Travis was lying at some point. He said so many different things. They admit the only time the state argued that he told the truth was when he offered a plea deal. The judge said, however, because of Travis's credibility, it's unlikely that his recantation would change the outcome, because if he's lied in the past, he'll lie now. So why should they believe him? The judges acknowledged the comments from the jury foreman that we referenced earlier, and his response that his hands are tied. He can't just go based on what a jury says or the testimony or the recantation of a known liar. He has legal parameters he has to stay within, and he has precedent that he has to follow. He said describing evidence as thin would be an understatement, but when you base a new trial on new information coming in, that there's not enough to grant that. I would argue that point. I think there certainly is enough, since there was no physical evidence to begin with, and the testimony that got them convicted is in question. I would think, yeah, let's take another look. But again, I have a hard time faulting this judge. It's hard to say that a lot's changed if there wasn't a lot there in the first place.
True. So at this point, the simplest path forward would be for the county office to reopen the case. In 2019, the lead prosecutor even admitted that the state would have a hard time retrying the men because there is currently no evidence against them. But he would also say, quote, I don't feel any compulsion to have our office reopen this investigation because there may be something allegedly out there, and that this alleged newly discovered stuff would indicate that they were not involved in the murder of Maurice Purify. We put everything we had in front of the jury. Travis testified, warts and all, and the jury did not rush to judgment, end quote. To me, Jamie, you can tell me if you disagree, but to me, that was a semi-eloquent way of saying, it's already done, it's in the past, let's just move on.
Well, I think that's what they're saying, but Wayne and Carl are still in jail. They've been in prison since they were 19 years old, and they're older than us. Both of them are over 40 now. Travis and Chandrea are trying to work with the Ohio Innocence Project to move Carl and Wayne's cases forward, but I don't know if that's actually going to happen. Wayne believes he had a future in basketball. Once he was not indicted the first time, that scared him into a situation where he was like, I'm going to focus. He's a 6'4" guy. Maybe it could have at least gotten him a college education. He wants to be free so he can spend some time with his kids. He's been locked up pretty much their entire lives. He had a newborn son when he was arrested. That son's now in college, and Wayne has missed his entire life. The two continue to fight for their freedom, but like we've discussed here, they're constantly met with roadblocks. And I realize that my tone this entire episode has been wrongful conviction, coerced confession, these poor guys that are in prison for something they didn't do. But the core of that frustration is there's been no justice for Maurice Purify and his family. I am very convinced that these are not the men that killed him.
Do you think Travis has any involvement in this at all, or was just coerced to make a confession and he threw his friends that he was angry with under the bus?
Yeah, I don't think Travis knew anything about it. At first, when you read, you deny it 25 times, his story builds up and changes. He never got the details right until they were fed to him. There was never a situation where he gave information that nobody should know to let us know that he was actually there when Maurice was killed. There was no tie to him knowing Maurice. I don't think Travis was involved. I think he was trying to get out from under this rape charge, and this was his way of doing so. And he thought, well, maybe I'll get a plea deal, and I know they didn't do it, so they're not going to get in trouble, but obviously they did. But again, I don't want people to say, I don't want us to get a review and say, oh, they don't care about the victims. They're out there bleeding hearts for murderers. No, like I want justice for Maurice Purify. Now, instead of losing one life of a young man, we've essentially lost the lives of three, because two of those have spent the whole time in prison. Travis was in jail for 18 years, but he was, given the rape charge, he probably should have been.
Yeah, that I'm was, down with that. That was coupled with a rape charge that we don't are not going to speculate on whether he did or did not do. But yeah, that's kind of how I feel too. And if you listen to the interviews of Travis, I mean, it's pitiful because this is a low IQ kid locked in a room with police officers for 6 hours and they are allowed to lie to him. And, I know that's a technique that is useful and it can catch people. And, but at the same time, man, like you mentioned the state and what was
trait.
I mean, low IQ, hungover, surprised that this is even happening. And for several hours, he says, I don't know what you're talking about. And then they're saying to him, look, your friends have told us that you did this.
Multiple people have told us you did this.
So, and then he's like, well, who told you that? Because it's a lie. And then they were like, we're not getting into that. But if you don't start cooperating with us, you're never going to be a free man. I mean, like, if you tell me that, and I'm like, I mean, I got to get out of this situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I don't know, man, it's tough. It's crazy.
And I get it. There are countries in the world where police cannot lie to you. And I'm afraid that a lot of people in America think they can't lie to you, but they absolutely can to get the information that they need. I had a detective that came over for dinner at my house the other night, John, and I was asking him
to be clear, he was there having dinner with you. He wasn't there investigating
anything. Yeah, that's why I threw the dinner thing in. I've told a couple of people that. I was
eating dinner and a detective barged in.
It was weird.
Started to ask me a question about burning down a neighbor's yard.
His wife was like, why are you all talking about the Reed technique? I asked him straight up, do you use the Reed technique in your interrogations? And he said, you know, I've learned about it, but for a lot of the crimes that I cover, it's not really appropriate. And we talked about that for a bit. We talked about familial DNA. So he may be willing to come on and talk to us about some of these things. And I'm not saying the police officers were being malicious in that they were corrupt. I think they thought they had the guy and they were willing to do what they could to get the conviction. I think people can do bad things with good intentions. Yeah. I think that's mostly what we see in these cases.
Something we didn't see was him asking for an attorney and one being there during questioning, which is something we always talk about. Jamie, I don't care if I get brought downtown because an officer saw me run a stop sign. I'd be like, dude, I am not talking to you unless my lawyer's here.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And that goes back to the low IQ thing. Was he capable of understanding his Miranda rights and the possible ramifications of what was going to happen? I don't know.
Yeah. But you don't need an attorney. I mean, you're fine. There's nothing to hide here.
Yeah. They went back and forth between that of, we know you were that. You didn't do it, but we know you know, to, man, you're going to go to jail for the rest of your life. Like, whatever would motivate him is what they were saying. It's very much, let's throw all of our techniques against the wall and see what sticks. So this is a very frustrating case for me. I want justice for Maurice Purify, for his family. I would love to see Wayne and Carl get another crack at proving their innocence. So I think there's a lot of work to be done at this case, and I think it can be done. I think we can get to justice. I think they need to go back to some of those original conversations they had with Terry Lake and Aaron Pettis. And I think they need to revisit some of that because that seemed more promising than what locked these guys up for the last 20 plus years.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to beat a dead horse, man, but like my son is 13 years old. So I definitely empathize with Maurice and his family. Like if I found my little boy laying in the middle of the road, I would want justice, but I wouldn't want just anybody to face justice. I would want the person actually responsible.
Yeah.
Because I would feel like I've not only lost my son, but other parents have lost their children as well if I felt like the wrong people were behind bars for my son's murder.
Like I said, his brothers come around to believe that they're innocent. So that's a common viewpoint from all involved. Would love to hear what our listeners think. You may think we're completely off base. And just because I interviewed a wrongful conviction attorney the other day, that's where my mindset is. But I've been locked into this case for months before I was able to talk to Elizabeth Franklin Best. I do encourage you to go check out that interview. She shared some fascinating things about behind-the-scenes law as it pertains to people that were perhaps wrongfully convicted, so certainly some interesting information.
Guys, we appreciate you tuning in each and every week. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, other social medias as well, and join us on Patreon.
Yeah, TikTok is our fastest growing social media platform right now. We would love to have you follow us over there. And personally speaking, it's a great way to kill, I don't know, 5 minutes, 4 hours, depends on what the algorithm's serving me.
Guys, we love you. And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
Listen to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.